Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, nearly 500 episodes and 7 years into the podcast, I cannot believe that we have yet to cover one of the most fashionable and glamorous parties that New York City has ever seen. So earlier this week, we chatted with the model, author, and philanthropist Penelope Tree and her recollections of attending this event, as well as this event's recent depiction in Ryan Murphy's hit television series, Feud, Capote versus the Swans. Well, it's time now. We're going to take you back in time today to Truman Capote's legendary black and white ball.
And for all of our listeners who might not be familiar with Truman Capote, he was a literary polymath of sorts. So a child prodigy who started writing seriously at age 11. He would rise through American literary society with ease and accolades, writing essays for the like of The Atlantic and The New Yorker. And as a novelist, Capote may be best known for penning Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is, of course, one of the most iconic movies of all time and stars Audrey Hepburn. But lesser known are the many, many Hollywood screenplays that Capote wrote or adapted.
Widely known, however, was the fact that Capote was gay. He was very much open about his sexuality in an era when same-sex relations could actually destroy one's professional career and or their personal relationships. So Capote's distinctive voice and his mannerisms were actually considered to be part of his charm within these elite social circles in which he held this captivating sway as a personage or personality. And this was especially so in 1966, when his novel In Cold Blood, which actually documented this mystery surrounding the murder of the Cutter family in rural Kansas, well, his novel rocked the literary world. Now looking back on it, it could be said that it was one of the first true crime hits, but In Cold Blood earned something like a staggering $57 million in today's money. And this really cemented Capote in not only his relevance in intellectual circles, but now also a man of substantial means.
So let's just say when Capote announced that he had plans to host a ball, it was the talk of not only New York, but also the international jet set. So those in the orbit of Capote, who was at this time society's favorite party guest, had been whispering about it since early June when the writer Bon Vivant began planning a, quote, nice dance for friends, just a party for people I like. And this party was held on a stormy Monday evening on November 28th, 1966. And let's just say it was far from just a party, April.
Not at all. He was downplaying that.
Yes, because Capote's event has now become legendary. And as it was called in the press, it was the ball of the century and a, quote, new 400 of the world.
And on that last bit that Cass just said, a new 400 of the world, this definitely requires a little bit of historical context, because this phrase, a new 400, is actually a historical reference to Ward McAllister, who was the 19th century gatekeeper of the New York social set. And this phrase came about because he once told a reporter from the New York Tribune that, quote, there are only 400 fashionable people in New York society. If you go outside that number, you strike people who are either not at ease in a ballroom or else make other people not at ease, end quote.
Yes, and if you've been watching The Gilded Age, then you have met this character, who really was a character. I mean, he's played so well by Nathan Lane.
Amazing.
Absolutely love it. So he was elitist, snobbish, and insular. And of course, I'm talking about the real Ward McAllister. And of course, this is certainly portrayed in The Gilded Age, where we see how 19th century New York society was largely based around this ongoing game of old money families attempting and ultimately failing to keep new money families out of their social circles. An invitation to one of the many lavish balls of this period, like the 1892 Astor Ball, could actually make or break your social reputation, and the stakes were high to stay relevant within or move up the the ranks of the New York elite. McAllister's list of 400 were the old moneyed movers and shakers of New York who courted, married, and really socialized within their own ranks.
Yeah, and we've actually done a couple of past episodes on how New York society operated in the 19th century, including one on a different ball that we did in 2019, which was the Vanderbilt Ball. And also, we've done a couple of episodes now on etiquette codes at the Gilded Age. So you can return to those if you want to learn more kind of like about this time period that we're talking about. But let's just say that Truman Capote's 1966 Black and White Ball was very much based on a historical precedent of New York's elite balls of the past. But actually what he set out to do would have been unthinkable to these hostesses of yore. He actually set out to blast society wide open to invite the global artistic and intellectual elite for the most elaborate ball that the 20th century had ever seen.
So for months, Truman carried around a cheap notebook, handwriting in its lined pages his guest list for this party of the century. And, you know, as we mentioned, he's one of the most famous and beloved authors and personalities of his day. He was a member of this global glitterati, let's just say. And this counted among its elite people like heiresses, Oscar winners, political figures. All of these people were his friends. He moved around the world, he encountered people who interested them, and then he added their name to his potential guest list.
So fabulous.
And reportedly, Capote handed his notebook over to his secretary to begin issuing invitations in October of 1966, so a month before the party. And when he did this, there were 658 names of, quote, diplomats, politicians, scientists, painters, writers, composers, actors, producers, dress designers, social figures, tycoons, and Truman said himself, international types, lots of beautiful women, and ravishing little things.
I'm going to guess that the ravishing little things were cute boys, just saying. Happy Pride, everyone. So yeah, Capote's invitees were entreated to attend an evening of revelry in the form of a formal costume, aka for in the UK, fancy dress ball, which was to be held at New York City's Plaza Hotel. And it's very beautiful and decadent ballroom. And the dress code was to be strictly black and white, and masks were required. The more fabulous, the better. And as Capote would explain in the press, the masks were not just meant to solely impart an air of mystery, but they were actually to encourage the guests to mingle amongst themselves and to expand rather than to restrict their social connections. So this is the exact opposite of what Ward McAllister was saying with his 400. He said, quote, the whole point is to ask anyone you want to dance and to sit wherever you want. And when the masks come off at midnight, you can find your own chums or stay with your new ones.
And while today the intermingling of creatives, politicians, members of the social set, you know, that seems relatively routine to us today.
Very much so.
Yeah, at this time in the 1960s, Capote's idea of bringing together interesting individuals from all different professions, from all different parts of the world, was pretty novel. And word spread like wildfire of Capote's soiree, which quickly became the most coveted social invitation in years. For Capote, however, this turned into a bit of a cluster. Those who felt snubbed because they were not invited began harassing and even threatening him. So much so that he was forced to disconnect his phone line and retreat to the country to escape the mounting pressure of his impending party.
I mean, this is some serious business, right?
He was probably getting a total kick out of it, too.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. He was not a bit above a little bit of egotism, it must be said. But it wasn't only the people, also the publications that were stoking this sort of anticipation of the party. And there is so much press coverage of this event, not only after the event, but leading up to it, that I did not look at any sources outside of the contemporary primary source press sources in writing this episode. And I didn't even touch all of it. So it could be, maybe one day a much longer episode, or maybe we should do a class on it. That would be really cool, like a visual history class. So much of this press was actually leading up to it, right? There was an active mechanism feeding all this information to the New York fashion press and just the press in general. For instance, the New York Daily Record began publishing illustrations of the masks that some of the noted prominent gentlemen would be wearing to the party. And the coverage of the party in Women's Wear Daily is literally daily for weeks and weeks and weeks leading up to the party. Even Paris's Bureau of Women's Wear Daily reported on what French socialites were going to be wearing. For instance, the Comtesse Brandolini's ensemble was going to be a matching black velvet cap mask and a full skirted gown by Madame Gray, while Moriera de Sales was going to be attending wearing head-to-toe Marc Bohan for Dior, and her resplendent rhinestone mask actually had this crazy towering rhinestone mobile on it, you know, mobiles with the moving parts, and it was like all rhinestones from her headpiece.
Yes, there's so many cool images to see and to kind of revel in from this evening. That includes looking at actor Candace Bergen, who donned a black velvet and white mink gown by Halston, while the ball's honored guest Kay Graham, who was the president of the Washington Post and Newsweek, wore a white wool crepe gown and matching mask sprinkled with jewels, created custom for her by the House of Belmont.
Yeah, jewels at this event, holy moly, anticipating that many of the women, especially the socialites, would arrive dripping in them, Capote had the prescience of thought to hire a detective whose sole function at the event was to guard the safety of the women's jewels at the party. And this included the Italian fashion designer Princess Luciana Pignatelli, who wore a 60-carat diamond dangling from the front of her headdress, and it rested in the center of her forehead. Well, Mrs. Lowell Guinness complained to Capote that her two necklaces that she was wearing, one was rubies, the other one was diamonds, were so heavy that she feared that she was going to have to stay in bed the rest of the day.
Oh, life is so hard. I want to know more about this Italian fashion designer princess that you mentioned. As a side note.
Yeah, I kind of delved into her just a tiny little bit, but I was like, I have to finish doing this episode.
Dress listeners, whether you find yourself in menopause, perimenopause, or simply experiencing racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, and feeling tired all the time, or even a low sex drive, Hormone Harmony is here to help you get back to feeling like yourself again.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And their Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like the chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Hormone Harmony uses only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. That's probably why there are more than 17,000 reviews of Hormone Harmony.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
So the day following the party, the New York Times noted, quote, no recent party has been so secured. And that was probably because the NYPD were the ones securing the entrances to the Plaza Hotel, because one of the attendees had her own Secret Service detail. 22-year-old Linda Bird Johnson, who was, of course, daughter of the sitting president of the United States, Lyndon B. Johnson, was in attendance. As Gloria Steinem wrote in her coverage of the event for Vogue, Linda, quote, arrived with her Secret Service men, who in black tie and black mask looked more like Secret Service men than ever.
And Linda Bird was not the only first daughter or daughter of a U.S. president in attendance. President Theodore Roosevelt's daughter, Alice Roosevelt, was actually there, which is incredible. Like, just thinking about this entire time period, because at this time she was 82, and her and Capote actually had this ongoing joke and competition about who could wear the least expensive costume to the ball. And Alice adapted a 35-cent mask, which would be about like $3 today, and fastened it to her head with adhesive tape. Whereas Capote, who is the host of this completely insane party, wore a 39-cent domino from FAO Schwartz. And if you guys don't know what a domino is, it's basically a rubber cloak that has a hood on it. So I guess it seems like the expense invested in costumes kind of ran the gamut. But as the New York Times reported, it was, quote, the most exquisite of spectator sports. Lots of other masks were far more elaborate, and some, those involving feathers, flowers, and rhinestones, were reputed to have cost as much as $600. So that would cast be the equivalent of about $6,000 today, just for your mask or your headpiece.
And then guests removed these masks at midnight and could now recognize their fellow attendees who, among so many others, we don't have time to mention them all, but the guests included people like Mia Farrow, who was there with her boyfriend Frank Sinatra, Gordon Parks, Claudette Colbert, Douglas Fairbanks, Billy Baldwin, Henry Fonda, American fashion designer Donald Brooks, Joan Fontaine, while artist Renee Boucher's widow, who had one half hair white, one half of her hair black, as well as those that the New York Daily Record noted as Fords, Shrivers, Gimbels, Hearsts, Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, Rothschilds, and even Windsors.
And while some of Capote's invitees came from these very established New York families, the New York Times went out of their way actually to point out that the black and white ball was in many ways the exact opposite of Ward McAllister's insular ideology of this 400 elite. The New York Times said, quote, roughly 2% of Mr. Capote's guests could have made the original 400. Although Mr. Capote invited the Harrimans, Phippses, and Rockefellers, they would not have been on Mr. McAllister's list because their money was then too new.
Bogue remarked on the evening in a 9-page editorial in January of 1967, quote, so much beauty, power, talent, and celebrity hadn't been collected in one room since an inaugural ball, end quote. Capote's guests danced and dined on a menu planned by his close friend Babe Paley of chicken hash and spaghetti bolognese, pastries and coffee, which they washed down with 400 bottles of vintage Tattinger champagne. One press source cited the food and beverage bill alone for the party as $13,000, which would be a whopping $125,000 today.
We have to remember he was a multimillionaire at this point and was celebrating, so there's that. And of course, if any of you did watch Capote versus the Swans, you will know how close that Truman and Babe Paley were. Like, this is kind of like the centerpiece of that entire television series. And this brings up another very interesting aspect to the ball. Truman came up with an idea to tap certain people within New York society to entertain guests prior to the ball at intimate dinner parties in their own homes. So you're going to have dinner with these people, and then you're going to come to the party, which started at 10 p.m. Along with Babe Paley, socialites like Mrs. George Backer, Marion Javits, the actor Margaret Sullivan, and also very creative intellectuals, including Cecil Beaton, Jason Epstein, who was the editor of the Random House Publishing House at the time, and publishers Gardner and Flora Cowles were amongst a few of these dinner party hosts that he asked to do this. And Capote remarked, quote, I put the dinners together myself. That was the real game. I'd call up and take a person from one dinner and put him at another. I did my best, end quote.
We know from the fashion press that Babe Paley hosted a pre-party dinner for 36 people as a reporter from Women's Wear Daily seemingly stalked her lobby that evening, reporting on the comings and goings of Babe's additional staff, including caterers, florists, her hairdresser, who exited to tell the reporter that Babe was doing her own makeup.
Hot goss.
The reporter also hounded the doorman to inquire about the contents of the grocery bags delivered earlier in the day to try to ascertain what was to be served. I mean, this is a lot.
And I mean, this was literally published in Women's Wear Daily. She was like giving like updates of what was happening every 15 minutes as she's hanging out in this lobby. I don't know. It was very stalkerazzi, to be honest. And just as a side note, the coverage of the black and white ball in terms of paparazzi didn't end once the last person was exiting and the plaza and personally thanked by Capote, which he did for each individual guest. The following day, Women's Wear Daily reporters staked out all of these favorite high society haunts, like the restaurants Lafayette and La Côte Basque, which is, if you know Capote's work, it's a very specific reference. I'm going to move on. But basically, they were stalking out these restaurants to report on who from the party was having breakfast or lunch with whom, what they were wearing. And the next day, the entire page of Women's Wear Daily is like taken up by these illustrations of Kenneth Paul Block, who is a fashion illustrator of the time, illustrating Truman and Babe lunching with their friends. And, you know, we have to remember that in many ways, these socialites were living in a fishbowl of and also courting the press, because Babe Paley had her own press secretary. So I don't know. Has this game changed much today?
And it was not only the fashion press that realized the significance of what Capote had accomplished by bringing so many notable personalities together. So too did the Museum of the City of New York, which in early 1967 acquired at least four masks that were worn to the black and white ball, as well as the swan headdress worn by Mrs. Frederick Eberstadt for their costume collection. And Miss Stearns, who was the curator for decorative arts and costumes for the Museum of the City of New York, told reporters at the time that, quote, "We wanted to document the Capote ball because we have clothing worn at all of the historic balls in New York City." And that is very true.
For Truman, the ball was a smashing success beyond his wildest dreams, perhaps, or maybe not. But it was remarked upon that he only danced with three of his female guests that night. And in his words, quote, "I just stood there thinking how marvelous it was that these people had made such an extraordinary effort." And really, truly extraordinary it was. You know, there was a country doctor who was mingling with a Maharaja. There were composers who were chatting with businessmen. And the detectives from Kansas who solved the Cutter family's mystery, which is at the center of Truman's book In Cold Blood, were photographed chatting with very major Hollywood stars. So this was a very cool event, and people were fascinated by it. And I just also want to point out that in the middle of all of this, we have the party's youngest guest, 16-year-old Penelope Tree, for whom this party would actually launch her modeling career the next morning at 9 a.m. because fashion photographer Richard Avedon had noticed her in this amazing black slit up to there custom curtain by Betsy Johnson. And it was made specifically for the party, for Penelope, during Betsy Johnson's early years at Paraphernalia. So if you want to hear more about this, you can hear Penelope tell that story for herself. You can tune into our episode from earlier this week.
Well, I think that does it for us today, dress listeners. We hope that you have enjoyed this brief peek into the story behind one of 20th century New York's most fashionable parties and ponder what you would have worn next time you get dressed. Dress listeners, with the world watching, what does the clothing of Olympic athletes say without having to say a word? I am so excited, as many of you know, about the upcoming 33rd Olympic Games this summer.
She's obsessed. Cass is obsessed with the Olympics.
And I'm so excited that I'm actually bringing you a live two-part class, Worn to Win, Dressing the Summer Olympic Athlete. In this two-part class, we will be looking at the significance of the clothing worn throughout history by athletes competing in the Olympics. We're going to be covering 2,800 years of history with a focus on the U.S. Olympic team. And this class is the first in the new Picturing Dressed series, which features live lectures that will visually illustrate Dress the History of Fashion podcast. The Worn to Win will coincide with the airing of the Dressed episodes of the same name. If you'd like to join me, you can head to our website, dressedhistory.com. It's going to be on July 28th and August 4th. And while you're there, you can also sign up for my What Women Wore to the Revolution class, which is currently in session. Where can they sign up for events with you in their future, April?
Well, you can head over to dressedhistory.com, which is where we have all the information about our new offerings from Dressed. If you happen to find yourself or you live in New York City, you can join me on Fridays at the Met, obviously the Metropolitan Museum of Art, for tours where we investigate and see 10 of the Met's permanent collection's most fashionable masterpieces. And this is an hour and a half tour. They're becoming increasingly popular. If you guys want to schedule me on a day that's not a Friday, I'm happy to do bigger groups or special events for you. So just let us know. If you would like to do that, you can actually send me an email at hello@dressedhistory.com. Alternately, you can also DM us on Instagram, which is @dressed_podcast. This is, of course, where we always post images to accompany all of our episodes. And if you want to find the Instagram content specifically related to this episode, you can search the hashtag dressed494. That's dressed494.
Also, did you know you can listen to the show ad-free for just $3 a month? You can subscribe to the exclusive content version of Dressed, which does not have ads. You can find the link to that in our show notes. Thank you for always, Dressed listeners, for tuning in. More Dressed coming your way next week. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.